I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm happy to be welcoming back Nancy Lechuga as my co-host.
It's good to be here again, Daniel. Thank you.
And today, Nancy and I are going to talk to Tim Z. Hernandez, whose new book, Mañana Means Heaven, has just come out, and it's about B. Franco, who is the Mexican girl that occasionally appears in the literature of Jack Kerouac. And for the poem of the day, keeping with the theme, Nancy's going to read a poem by Jack Kerouac. You know, speaking of Kerouac, I remember when I was in grad school, I tried to read his novel. What's the name of his novel? On the Road, that really famous novel where B. Franco, in fact, shows up. And the thing that impressed me the most about that was the word verdant. He uses that word a lot. He's talking about the verdant hills, verdant this, verdant that. And at the time, I didn't know verdant was just another way of saying green, right? But then years later, when I started to read García Lorca. He has that
verde.
Yeah, exactly. That poem, which is a beautiful, beautiful poem. I thought, oh, well, there's the connection. Verde. In English, it's verdant. And it's...
Yes, I actually have a story about Federico García Lorca in Verde Que Te Quiero, Verde Amor.
Oh, yeah?
My mom was the one that introduced me to Federico García Lorca, and she didn't even know. It's because there's used to be this Mexican soap, Zest.
It's also a non-Mexican version called Zest, I believe.
Yeah, and it's a green soap, and whenever my mom would give me a bath, she's like, Verde Que Te Quiero, Verde Amor.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And later when I was introduced to, when I started reading Lorca and I saw that, I was like, oh my God, my mom was reading poetry to me at, you know, when I was 5 years old and she didn't even know.
Wow, so. That's awesome. Verde, que te quiero verde. And the way people usually translate it when they're doing it is in English and they say green, I love you green. But really, maybe a better translation would be verdant, huh? Verdant, I love your verdancy or something like that. But I remember reading that book and it's basically, I think it's the most well-written book in the world, but it's certainly interesting. It's about this road trip, and it's certainly the seminal road trip book, going on the road and doing a lot of drugs. And just it kind of reminded me of a little bit of Edward Abbey, who also wrote these books about environmental terrorism. But I remember his character would measure distance by six-packs. So he would say, for example, from Phoenix to L.A., it's 2 six-packs. And it was, again, just that kind of that craziness on the road thing. And I travel a lot, too, but I don't tend to drink beer or do drugs while I'm traveling.
Yeah.
I wait until I get there, and that's when I start the drugs and the beer.
Oh, okay.
Well, this is going to be a really interesting show because I know Tim Z. Hernandez has done a lot of research on Jack Kerouac and B. Franco, the Mexican girl that appears in his literature. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. So stick around.
Tim Z. Hernandez is a poet, novelist, and performance artist whose awards include the 2006 American Book Award, the 2010 Premio Aslan Prize in Fiction, and the James Duval Phelan Award from the San Francisco Foundation. His poems and stories have appeared in numerous anthologies and journals, and his books have been widely acclaimed, including a spot on NPR's All Things Considered. In 2011, the Poetry Society of America named him one of the 16 new American poets. He holds a BA from Naropa University and an MFA from Bennington College and currently calls the Rocky Mountains home. Welcome, Tim, to Words on a Wire.
Hey, thank you. No, it's my pleasure.
Hey, and congratulations on this beautiful book, Mañana Means Heaven. It has been getting so much attention. It was reviewed by the Los Angeles Times. So first of all, before we get into it, tell us a little bit about this book and what it's about and how it came about.
Well, you know, the book is based on the life of a woman named B. Franco, who was, she was the real life person and the inspiration for Jack Kerouac's story called The Mexican Girl. And the Mexican girl actually first appeared in his book On the Road. And what folks don't know is that it was that story, The Mexican Girl, of this woman, B. Franco. It was this story that actually opened the doors for the publication of Jack Kerouac's novel, On the Road.
Oh,
it had been,
really?
You know, yeah, it had been rejected. He started trying to get published in 1951. It was rejected for 6 years. And it wasn't until this excerpt was published in the Paris Review and then picked up by the 1956 Best American Short Stories. And then months after that happened for this story, then Viking Press accepted it for publication. So that's what opened the doors, yeah.
So what was it about this B. Franco that got the attention of the editors that opened up the door for him?
And on the road, it's really sort of the most, as a lot of sort of his own biographers and critics of Kerouac have, you know, observed over time, and that's that. It's really that chapter, about 19-20 pages, about B. Franco, when he meets B. Franco, who, just to give the listeners some context, you know, she was a migrant farm worker from San Joaquin Valley there, Selma, California, near Fresno.
Which is where we're from.
That's where we're from, that's right, yeah. That's thus my interest in the story. But, you know, she was from there, and when he was, you know, traveling sort of across the country, back and forth, you know, living it up and all that, this is the one time in his book On the Road where he actually kind of sits still for a moment, and it's kind of, he suspends sort of, you know, his sort of wild ideas and really kind of considers for a moment love and considers wow. an alternate life, you know, this life of settling down and having a farm and all that. And so it's a real tender moment in the book, and that's I think that's why it stood out and why the Paris Review wanted to publish it.
And this book, you've been working on it for many years. I know you pretty well. We hang out occasionally when we're in the same city. You've been working on this for a long time, and you've been doing a lot of research. Can you tell us a little bit about what went into to finally getting this beautiful book out?
You know, originally the idea wasn't to find her or her family. The idea was I was just going to fictionalize, you know, that story and On the Road and kind of do a sort of spin-off from that. But, you know, before any you can take on a book, as we know, you know, we have to look it up and research and see if it's already been done, see what's out there. And in that stage is where I discovered, you know, her name was mentioned in over 22 Kerouac biographies and her story, yeah, and sort of her role in Kerouac's career. And I said, well, you know, but the interesting part was that no one had ever actually found her or asked her. So all of this was sort of hearsay. It was all really sort of via Kerouac's narrative, Kerouac's point of view. And so, you know, I ended up starting to look for her family in around, oh, gosh, I want to say maybe at the early part of 2010, I started to search for her family. Anyway, it was a search that lasted about 2 years. And, you know, I met you at one point in Los Angeles, and even I sort of sort of brought you along, or actually you took me along, and we went looking for her house there in Los Angeles where Kerouac had sent her letters and all of that. But, you know, this was a search research that took sort of a journey that took me from L.A. to sort of old-time labor camps in Fresno and that area to New York City, looking at her papers that are in the archives there. And so I really went all over the place, and then for about 2 years I looked for her. And when I decided to give up and surrender and stop looking for her, I ended up finding her living only a mile and a half from my home in Fresno.
Wow.
Yeah, she was alive.
You got to know her.
Yeah, I sat down with her family. I mean, you know, after it took some convincing, because they weren't aware of any of this sort of, you know, legacy around Kerouac. And you know, B at the time was age 90 years old already. So I was speaking mostly with her children as well as her. And they weren't aware of any of this. So I had to sit down and kind of convince them of who they were, you know, that they were the same family that Kerouac had wrote about is really what I was doing. And after I did that, which took a couple of visits and still, you know, even further on, we kept talking about it and all that. And but after that, we sat down and interviewed. And right away, I asked her permission. I told her I wanted to write a book about her. I asked her if she knew about any of the 22 biographies she'd been in. She said no. I asked her if anyone ever knocked on her door and asked her about this. She said never. And so I right away started to film her. They allowed me to film these interviews. So right away she allowed me to interview her and to film these interviews. And so I started to film them and just sit down with her as much as possible. And the whole idea of a book was on the back burner at this point. I just wanted to get the information on video, tape, and audio. And I sat with her and interviewed her probably steadily twice a week for about 3 months. That's what I ended up sort of scrapping the whole completely fictional portion of the book or aspect of it, and just started from scratch again and writing the book based on our interviews.
So why B. Franco? Why did you decide to write about what called your attention? Why did you decide to write about her and this relationship with Jack Kerouac?
Yeah, you know why? Because I had walked out of a class. This was in 2007. I was an undergraduate still at Naropa University here in Boulder, Colorado, which is also known as the Jack Kerouac School. And we were talking a lot about beat lineage in the classroom. And when the class was over, I left the class, and I was thinking about that idea of lineage. And the professor at the time sort of alluded to the idea that we're all sort of a part of that beat lineage because of, you know, the fact that we're there studying there and all that. And And I left the class a little skeptical of that. And I opened up On the Road after class, and I was looking at it. And suddenly, I was kind of looking for something of myself inside of the book, really. And that's when this story emerged at me. And I had read this story before, you know, twice before. But it never jumped out at me, like in this one moment now, when I'm sort of standing at this intersection of beat lineage and sort of being a son of migrant farm workers from the same place as B. Franco. And I suddenly wanted to know more about her in that moment. And that's how it all started. I think looking back now, I think it was really sort of my way of offering something to that dialogue, contributing something to that classroom dialogue of lineage. Yeah.
And, you know, there's always been a lot of Chicano poets that have, you know, admired, you know, the Beats and admired Jack Kerouac. And, and what this book does is, in many ways, it shows how connected we really are, because right. the experience that he lived with B. Franco rubs up so much against our own experience.
Oh, yeah, you know, and that's something, I mean, just in speaking with some of the, you know, Chicano writers that came out of the sort of, you know, the 60s and all of that, folks like Juan Felipe Herrera and, you know, Victor Martinez, folks like that, you know, they were influenced by the Beats. You know,
right.
Lorna D. Cervantes has a great essay where she says Ginsberg was the first Pachuco poet she knew, you know, that kind of, you know, right. and I sort of have this belief that, you know, since the Beats were delving as, you know, they were dipping their creative ladle in Latin America since the 40s, you know, they were doing that since the 40s. They were going to Mexico. Burroughs wrote about Peru and, you know, Kerouac about Mexico a lot. They were doing this since the 40s and 50s, so that by the time the 60s came around, you know, as sort of the whole sort of Chicano consciousness came around, I think a lot of the writers, and this is just a guess, of course, but, you know, as you start to look at the Beats, started to see something very familiar within their work,
right.
They were familiar with, you know, on the sort of undercurrent. And I think that was a big part of what, you know, why the influence there. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you started writing, did you start writing poetry?
Yeah, I actually went to school and studied poetry, and that's where I began, was writing poetry. My first book was a collection of poetry, and and then I just sort of evolved into prose.
And how was that transition from writing poetry to writing a novel?
Well, you know, this is my second novel. The first one was Breathing in Dust, and that one, I think, had a lot more sort of poetic language in that novel. But, you know, I've learned a lot. You know, for me, I still return to poetry at the end of a long, hard day of work. And to me, the long, hard day of work, I mean, writing prose for me is like having to sling a sledgehammer. You know, it's like, it's hard work. It really is. Whereas to me, poetry, I'm sure, is hard work as well. But it feels natural. When I write poetry, it feels natural to me. When I write prose, it really takes a lot of sort of brain muscle in my mind and all that. It doesn't come as naturally, I think. But I also, I really, you know, when I read a book, I really enjoy reading rich language. I enjoy reading line by line. You know, that's the way that's the kind of reading that I like to do. Like to sort of experience. And so I try to write my books, or my books actually sort of naturally come that way because poetry is my first place. And I really do sort of respect the line by line process of writing prose as well. So, and rhythm and all of that. So I feel like a lot of both of my novels have that in them still. Yeah.
Yes, I agree with you. And that's what makes your novel so engaging, the vivid language. And it really takes the reader there.
Thanks. Yeah, that's the idea, too. You know, in poetry, we can transcend time, much easier in one line than it is for me to do in prose. You know, in prose, right, we have to sort of, now we're getting kind of technical here, but, you know, prose, I think we have to kind of extend, you know, an idea. So when I'm using poetry in a story like this, I'm able to, you know, enrichen a sort of a line or a thought, you know, just by, with one sentence. And that's kind of the idea here, is to really capture several, because I'm trying to do several things in this book. You know, one is, you know, give a real experience for a Latina farm worker in the 1940s in that region of the world. At the same time, make a sort of almost a commentary against Kerouac's narrative and his version of the details. So I'm trying to do so much in one book. So it's really good to use poetry for that.
You seem to sometimes geek out when it comes to the research part of your work.
Yeah,
you like it. You like doing that research. I mean, you really enjoyed. It seems to me, all the research you did for this book, Mañana Means Heaven.
Yeah, I do geek out, man. That's for sure. You know, you know, when I was a kid, my mother said, you know, when you were young, you used to always ask why for everything, and you know, as most kids do, why, and my parents, so I think growing up, fed into that. You know, they loved that I asked why often. And then as I got older, I started to add who and how and when and what. You know, and I'm still very much you know, in line with that. I mean, I love questioning, and especially once you, you know, kind of once you walk down that dark tunnel of investigation and research, you know, it's like it's hard to turn back, because you start to look at, I think, our history and what we perceive sometimes as myths and things like that, or history. We start to look at that differently than we did before, you know, because we start to realize that a lot of it is paper thin, in fact, you know, a lot of it can be, or a lot of it is very just sort of surface stuff that we have discovered as human beings along the way, and we have something as individuals to offer to that conversation as time moves on, and that, so that's something that excites me, is that I get to contribute to that dialogue that was a question that might have been posed 60 years ago, we're answering today.
And, you know? you've done extensive research on the plane crash victims in the Central Valley in Coalinga. You've been doing a lot of research on that and been instrumental in getting them, you know, these people recognized. Can you tell us a little bit about that and whether or not this is ever going to make a nonfiction book? And is there a nonfiction book coming up in Hernandez's future?
Yeah, you know, that's a scary thought, but it's very possible. So how this project got started was I was doing the research for Mañana Means Heaven, and I was actually looking at old newspapers of 1947 and 48 there in Fresno County in California. I was trying to find where the labor camps in Selma would have been located at, and I ended up, during that process, I ended up seeing this headline, newspaper headline, that said 100 people see a airplane fall out of the sky. You know, very dramatic headline, and I started to read it, and by the time I was done with that, I realized right away it was the same incident that Woody Guthrie had wrote his song, The Deportees, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, that he wrote it about, you know. And so I thought, again, you know, very sort of fictional, just as it started with B. Franco's book, I said, you know, it'd be great if somebody, or if I wrote a book of fiction, if I wrote a book of fiction, 28 chapters and each chapter would be one person's name on that plane, and I would just tell you their story, you know, 28, which I think is still a great idea for a fictional book, but that's how it started. And next thing I know, I'm looking for this list of names, trying to find out who the passengers were. And I thought, well, you know, I'll include their real name as each title, a section for each chapter, their real name, and then I'll just fictionalize their story, their background. And that's what prompted me to look for the list of names of who they were. Next thing I know, here we are about 2 years later now, 2.5 years later from that day. And we found the list of names. I worked with the Fresno Cemetery also on this, and because they were buried in a mass grave there at the Holy Cross Cemetery in Fresno. All 28 Mexicans who were being deported were all buried there, anonymously buried there. They had a small headstone marker that for 60 years, 65 years, has read, you know, 28 Mexican nationals who died in a plane crash.
Wow.
Buried here. Yeah, anyway, so I worked with the church and raised $10,000 to put a new headstone there listing all of the names of the people that are buried there. And so, yeah, all of this, again, was, you know, it was research for a book, which along the way I've been able to interview now folks like the eyewitnesses. There was a 10-year-old who eyewitnessed the crash, whose family were the first responders, and she eyewitnessed the whole tragedy. And she's someone I've interviewed her, and her interviews will be in my book. Interviewed the family of, you know, obviously we found some of the victims' families who are actually in Fresno, but they're originally from Guanajuato. I've interviewed them. So this book is really a combination now. It's turning out to be a combination of a lot of transcribed interviews, so very sort of Studs Terkel-ish, you know.
Uh-huh,
Terkel.
Right, yeah. Working,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, like Working in some of his other oral history. You know, I don't know if it's, I think publishers would be afraid to call it nonfiction,
right,
because there's
right.
also, I look at the book more like a documentary in text. You know, and so
right.
In a documentary, you have, you know, actual sort of right interviews, but then you also have sort of reenactments and that kind of thing going on within it. And that's what my book will have, some of that as well. So,
well, Tim, we're running out of time here, but there is one thing I wanted to mention about Mañana Means Heaven, the story of B. Franco, Jack Kerouac's Mexican girl.
Yeah.
It's her story. It follows her as a little girl, and it goes back, it moves through time, goes back and
yeah.
forth in time, and includes her in her 90s. I think it does a great service to her memory and to, you know, her significance in literature and her significance in the life of Mexican women and Latinos in the Central Valley. And right when this book came out, it seemed she died.
Yeah. Oh.
And was she able to see the book?
Yeah, she did. You know, she had held on for the whole 3 years that I knew her and that I worked on the book. And I kept telling her, promising her it would come. And finally, in August, on August 7th, In early August, I got the box of books. I sent it to her, sent her a copy. On August 7th, she received the book. My book was supposed to be released officially on August 29th. So on August 7th, she got the book in the mail. Her daughter called me. They were excited. Bea was really happy with the way she looked on the cover and all that. So I said, Patricia, I asked her daughter, Patricia, can you take photographs of your mother for me? And she said, yeah. So she took some photographs of Bea holding the book, and she texted them to me, like sent them to me over the phone. And so those would become the only photographs that we would ever see of Bea Franco holding her book. Wow. Because 7 days later, she passed away.
Oh, wow.
It's sad, but it's beautiful. It's beautiful that she was able to hold that book before she left. I bet it meant a lot to her. And, you know, in a kind of beautiful sort of way, she was ready to die when she saw it.
Yeah, you know, that's what her family expressed, actually. Her family has said that, the book itself has really kind of, you know, been their way of just finding that closure for their mother. And in fact, they've been the biggest advocates, obviously, of the book. They've been the really sort of biggest supporters. They've been pushing it out there and letting people know their mother's story now, and they're really happy about it. And you know, ironically, auspiciously, I think is the word, auspiciously, the day that she had her funeral was August 29th, and that was the day that my book was released, August 29th.
It's almost meant to be. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. Thank you for doing this, Tim.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure, really. And I appreciate it, Daniel and Nancy, for all your work on Words on a Wire.
We've been talking to Tim Z. Hernandez, author of Mañana Means Heaven.
For today's poem of the week, we have a poem by Jack Kerouac called Bowery Blues. The story of a man makes me sick. Inside, outside, I don't know why. Something so conditional and all talk should hurt me so. I am hurt. I am scared. I want to live. I want to die. I don't know where to turn in the void and when to cut out. For no church told me, no guru holds me, no advice, just stone of New York. And on the cafeteria we hear the saxophone, oh dead Ruby, died of shot in 32, sounding like old times and debombed, empty, decapitated, murdered by the clock. And I see shadows dancing into doom, in love holding tight the lovely asses of the little girls in love with sex, showing themselves in white undergarments at elevated windows, hoping for the worst. I can't take it anymore if I can't hold my little behind to me in my room. Then it's goodbye, samsara. For me, besides, girls aren't as good as they look. And samadhi is better than you think. When it starts in, hitting your head in with buzz or glitter gold, heaven's angels wailing, saying, we've been waiting for you since morning, Jack. Why were you so long? Dallying in the sooty room? This transcendental brilliance is the better part of nothingness, I sing. Okay, quit, mad, stop. That was Bowery Blues by Jack Kerouac.
This is Benjamin Alida Science for Words on a Wire. I continue with my musings on words, language, and memory. I fell in love with books at an early age, and reading became the lens through which I saw the world. And what are books but a collection of words strung together by a single author who has perhaps spent years gathering words together until at last there is a rich harvest gently or even angrily placed on the page? Everything became a book to me. When I was a boy, The Night Sky was a book to read. I didn't much like that I was told how to connect the stars. And who were the ancient Greeks, anyway, to dictate to my imagination? I wanted to connect the stars in my own way. Did no one see a coyote in the night sky? I once did. I was told that there was supposed to be a man in the moon, but the Mexicans believed there was a rabbit there. I decided everyone was wrong about this. I saw mountains. Perhaps a man lived in those mountains. and many rabbits too, and coyotes chasing those rabbits. The whole large and vast and mysterious world was a book to be read and deciphered. I decided that you could not decipher the world if you did not understand words. Perhaps I was fascinated with words because I grew up with two languages living inside me, fighting for my attention. I remember being confused when I realized not everybody spoke Spanish. Sometimes I knew a word for something in Spanish and didn't know the word for it in English. Even now, I move between allegiances, and yet it is so unnecessary to choose. But the truth is, I have chosen. I write in English, but always Spanish is sitting on my shoulder, whispering cadences that simply do not exist in English. That was the thing with words. They had a rhythm, and you could find that rhythm if only you had the patience and the discipline to put them together in a certain way. And if you grappled and fought and gave yourself over to words, then the song would reveal itself. Yes, yes, the lyric. The song was different in Spanish. And yet English, with its natural iambics, feels like home to me now. Iambic pentameter lines come to me all the time. Sometimes they are busting down the door. One day I just had to write a free verse sonnet, and it came so easily. I patterned it after one of John Donne's holy sonnets, perhaps his most famous one, and a poem I have always loved. In fact, I included a line from Donne's poem in my own poem. Here it is. To the desert. I came to you one rainless August night. You taught me how to live without the rain. You are thirst, and thirst is all I know. You are sand, wind, sun, and burning sky, the hottest blue. You blow a breeze and brand your breath into my mouth. You reach, then bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. You wrap your name tight around my ribs and keep me warm. I was born for you, above, below, by you surrounded. I wake to you at dawn. Never break your knot. Reach, rise, blow. Sálvame mi Dios, trágame mi tierra, salva, traga, break me. I am bread. I will be the water for your thirst. Near the end of the poem, I had to break out into Spanish. And yet I did not break the rhythm nor the spirit of the English sonnet. Sometimes words in English and words in Spanish don't have to be at war with each other. Sometimes they are friends. Sometimes they are lovers. For Words on a Wire, this is Benjamin Alire Sáenz.
We'd like to thank our guest, Timzy Hernandez, for joining us for this week's Words on a Wire. Don't forget to pick up his book, Mañana Means Heaven. And thank you, Nancy, for reading the poem of the week.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me and hanging out with me. It's good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here again.
Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Nancy Lechuga.
And don't forget, the next book you read
might save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a...